Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of Talking Snooker with Phil Haig and Nick Metcalf. Once again, talking about the game we all love.
Yes, we're here. We're now, well, I'm not going to say deep, but we're significantly into the snooker season. We've had quite a lot of action to watch in the old Championship League and been some really good stuff, but we'll get back to that later because you're about to introduce our very special guest.
Very much so, Phil. Yeah, a week of action, the 23-24 season very much underway. I've really enjoyed watching it as well, actually. Very comforting, I think. Good to have the sport back. And as you say, we will reflect on week one of another marathon season later on in this episode. But the main focus of this new episode of Talking Snooker will be on a new book that is delighting snooker fans everywhere. Indeed, it's one of the most ambitious books ever written about this sport. And we are very pleased to say its author is alongside Phil and I today. This man is a lifelong snooker fanatic and a brilliant writer who in the past has tackled subjects as diverse as William Blake and American poetry in the Cold War. We're all very happy that he's now turned his attention to snooker, and we're very much looking forward to him sharing some of his nuggets of wisdom with us on the podcast. We are delighted to say that Brendan Cooper, the author of Deep Pockets, Snooker and the Meaning of Life, joins us on Talking Snooker. Brendan, it's great to see you. How are you?
I'm great, thank you. And thank you very much for having me on. And thank you for that immensely kind introduction. But it is a pleasure and a privilege to be here.
How very kind, sir. It's genuinely smashing to have you on. First question for me and from us. It's obvious your lifelong love of the game shines through with every page of this book. How did your love affair with this grand old sport start for you?
It started early. I do think that the great interests and passions of our lives, they often have their origins in early childhood experience. And that's certainly the case for me with snooker. I remember being 5 years old, being in my living room home, and it was actually a repeat of the 1985 final was on the TV screen, and I know it was a repeat because Davis and Taylor were sort of in the corner of the screen, sort of in a box, sort of commenting wryly on the final moments of the match and sort of, you know, teasing each other about it and so on. But it's a memory, it's a really important memory, actually, in my life. Not just a memory of snooker, but a memory of a sort of perfect, cozy homeliness, a feeling of safety and contentment at home as a young child. And so it catalyzed something really quite profound and significant within me. I've absolutely loved the game ever since then, and have always wanted somewhere at some point to write about it, and so you know, I feel fortunate to have had that opportunity.
And the idea for the book, I mean, it's an eye-catching title straight away, isn't it? Deep Pockets, Snooker and the Meaning of Life. Where did the idea for that come from?
Yeah, so I guess the title is, it's a bit of fun, Deep Pockets, but it's also, there's something I think about the game of snooker that, in my view, invites the kind of considerations that I've been trying to take in this book. You know, it's a game that is intriguingly slow, especially in relation to the sort of texture and the pace of contemporary culture. It's a game that's full of subtlety and mystery, of tactical complexity. You know, there are reasons why Clive James called it chess with balls in that famous phrase. You know, it is a game that is not just a game of skill, but a game of the mind. So I felt like the game itself warrants the kind of approach, the kind of angle I was wanting to take with the book, trying to connect it with the world of ideas and look at the game through the lens of various sort of philosophical concepts and so on.
Mm-hmm. And how much was that set out when you started, or did you go on a sort of a journey and you took in things that you weren't necessarily expecting to cover?
I guess something of a mixture, fundamentally. A lot of it came quite quickly. A lot of the ideas were fairly clear and obvious once I decided I wanted to take this approach, you know, thinking in terms of you know, concepts of victory and loss, and then the players and matches that I wanted to sort of bring into that. So quite a few of the chapters were fairly kind of rapidly on board. And as I went through, things shifted and slightly more niche ideas came into view. For instance, you know, having a chapter on fashion and snookering dress occurred to me at some point. Now, hang on a second, that this is really interesting, that, you know, the curiosity and eccentricity of this in contemporary sport is something that requires a little bit of reflection. So there are chapters like that actually there are serious elements to it, but it's also quite, in some ways, a sort of more lighthearted take on things as well. So something of a mixture, I'd say.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. One of the things that you mentioned sort of from the start, really, and something that I think I and we are fascinated by, is historically the lack of literature on this subject and the fact that we're not overladen with books. And, you know, we would see what we consider as contemporary sports, kind of equivalent sports, certainly in sort of public affection and, you know, just interest that have sort of library fulls of books compared to this sport. How much of that knowledge sort of kept you going with this? And I wonder why you think that might be, if you can try and lay it out for us, why historically there hasn't been an enormous amount written about this sport that we all love so much.
Yeah, it's a very good question. And it's something that has struck me and frustrated me for a very long time. You know, following the game, and if you look at other sports, and it doesn't need to be, you know, the biggest, the major sports of the world, but slightly more niche, what you might describe anyway as more niche sort of sports and pursuits, you find vast libraries of books of all kinds, you know, exploring the kind of culture and the history and the ideas surrounding those particular games. And when you compare snooker with, I think, anything else, it feels like the library is pretty thin. And it's especially pretty thin once you, if you take away the biographies of players, of which there are some wonderful and fascinating books out there. But I guess whenever you're reading a biography of a snooker player, you're fundamentally following the story of that particular human being, you know, and their life and the things that have happened to them. Books that are, you know, historical books on snooker, books that explore the kind of culture of the game, and so forth, you really are looking at a very small number in history. I don't exactly know why. You sometimes hear, I think, and it's an outrageous and false claim, but you do sometimes hear people say, oh, snooker doesn't translate particularly well to writing. And they'll make a claim that, well, if you know, Selby made a 63, he missed the blue, Robertson cleared up with a 71. It obviously is true. If you reduce snooker writing simply to that, to the sort of the bare facts and numbers, then it doesn't sound very interesting. But that seems to me to miss absolutely everything that is fascinating and rich about how we might use words in order to describe the game. So that was something I was wanting to try to in some way contribute to by writing this book.
That makes sense. Listen, we encourage everyone to get the book. There are myriad fascinating elements, and we'll only be able to cover some of them on this podcast today. But I am kind of interested in the pace of the game generally. You know, how snooker is kind of an outlier, which you explore in this fast paced world. And I think, without putting words in your mouth, you'll tell me and us, you think the slower and more sort of measured pace of this game should maybe be embraced more than it is.
I certainly think that it's, although it has at times been perceived as in some way a threat to the game, in fact, I think it's a strength. And it's interesting the degree to which it has sort of survived and thrived best in many ways. And it's, you know, the World Championship is an extraordinary phenomenon in 2023 to be happening. Games that are matches that are taking place across multiple days. These epic narratives, you know, I mean, the semi-finals are perhaps the kind of zenith of that, where you sort of have 3 days of these games kind of going on and you know, ebbing and flowing, and it isn't until perhaps the latter stages usually that you have any clear sense of who is actually going to win that match. That all sits quite uneasily with a contemporary culture where we kind of expect instant access to everything. But it's really popular. You look at the viewing figures, it remains the case that, you know, millions of people across the country, obviously across the world, when you go into the international audience, are watching this and enjoying it. And so I think you think of other sports, think of, you know, cricket as a sport where there has been a lot of attention to the idea that, you know, the 5-day test match in some way is under threat. And the introduction, not just of 2020, but then the 100 more recently, this sense that we need to satisfy a contemporary appetite for fast paced things and for shorter narratives. But I think that snooker shows something else. It shows that there is also another kind of appetite that's built into us, that is an appetite for the epic narrative and for slower, more incremental stories that unfold gradually, where small details and turning points and the various kinds are happening across potentially quite a substantial amount of time. And I think that is within human beings, that desire for those narratives. And so I think, yeah, that it's interesting, and it shows us something that snooker survives in the way it does in a contemporary world that looks like it should be hostile to it.
Mm. It just builds up to make the climaxes even bigger, doesn't it? I think the recent World Championship showed that so well. Those epic comebacks, especially from Luca against Ronnie and against C, they're made all the more special because you've had a day or two a build-up to do that. You know, if that was just the first session, then it wouldn't work. And it's interesting you mentioned cricket there, because I think a lot of it is what is perceived to be what people want. But actually, test matches are sold out all the time. They sell better than anything. And the World Championship's as popular as anything. So it just seems to be sort of what we think society wants compared to what, you know, it shows that people do like these long, drawn-out things.
Yeah, there's definitely an element of that, I think. And I think you're absolutely right. If you think about that extraordinary comeback from Luca, but, you know, it was a long comeback, you know, from such a kind of extraordinarily sort of, you know, hopeless position. And that made it all more dramatic. If you think about, you know, a couple of years ago, that extraordinary day when both of the world semifinals went to the deciding frame. But the drama of that, the drama of, you know, Kyron and Anthony McGill, and then, you know, later in the day, Ronnie and Mark Selby, it all going right down to the wire. The drama was intensified to that incredible, intense pitch because it had taken 3 days to get to that point. So there's something about the way in which these epic narratives, the kind of drama that can come from these longer narratives is unique, and you can't get it from, you know, a best of five.
And I will, I know you're a big cricket fan, so we will mention it while we're here because we've all been watching it. But that's been exampled in the first two tests this time, especially the first test, the climax of that with the build-up. What have you made? This is just a cricket question, but what have you made of the series so far?
I mean, it has been utterly astonishing. and the fact that, you know, to have two tests in a row that were as dramatic as that, dramatic in different ways, I feel like it would have been a wonderful thing for it to be 1-1 right now.
Yeah.
Because it that feels appropriate to the kind of intensity of the drama that we've seen. And obviously it's not, and it's going to be an awful job that England have. I have quite limited expectations about their capacity to do it. But yeah, exactly as you say, I mean, it's kind of the same point that the dramatic ending, everything that was happening with Stokes yesterday, almost pulling it off. Everything that was happening in the first test, with everything looking, you know, going right down to the wire and it looking like we're going to take the final wickets and then not, you know, if that had only been the sort of culmination of a couple of hours play, you wouldn't be feeling drama. But when it's at the end of 5 days, then suddenly it has this kind of dramatic intensity. And that's exactly the same with these sort of long, epic snooker matches, I think, in particular in the World Championships, but really any major final, you feel the same sense of, you know, dramatic culmination across a period of time. And that, I think, is an important element of the drama of snooker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it's not exact, obviously, but I think the World Championship is probably more closely linked to test cricket than anything else in sport, actually, isn't it? In many ways, that sort of long form, day after day of drama, slow burning. But you're being a bit coy. I mean, I think your cricket views are excellent. You very much did tip Australia, didn't you? I think you said it to me and to others before. You said that you thought they were the better side. And that's not proving that by much. But I think in the key moments, that they are kind of proving that because they're delivering really when it counts and they're big match winners and maybe turning up more than England's. But what a fascinating series, my goodness me. It's just it's such a funny series. I just have a slight feeling there's one more kind of big twist to come. I sort of half seeing them winning in Leeds because it's that sort of series now. And then sort of one up two to play. There's something about the narrative of the way that this is unfold. I know it's not a cricket podcast. more's a pity, Phil. You'd love it, wouldn't you?
But I'm there on Sunday, so I'll be cheering them on and booing the Aussies.
Well, I mean, it's going to be, you know, the fact that it's happening in Headingley with what happened to Johnny Bairstow, you know, the crowd is going to be lively, I think.
One of the great understatements. But back to your marvellous Western Terrace there, lively, Phil. They'll be using other words for that as well, won't they? More dramatic in the press. There's going to be some rum old scenes on there. But, it's quite touching at times. And I think maybe none more so than when you're sort of reflecting on memory and our pasts. Mm. And that I would use that word comfort at the top, didn't I, with tuning in for the early stages of this new season. I mean, you get into snooker at any time of life. And of course, we love people to get into it now if they're 40s, 50s. But for most of us, it's kind of a lifelong thing, I think. And you had that image of watching it when you were a young boy that you convey so brilliantly. And there's that quote from Lewis Gluck, isn't there? We look at the world once in childhood, the rest is memory. And that and the way we sort of, almost not everything, but so much is linked back to those early days. And it gives us all that sort of warm nostalgia. And sometimes, you know, when you look at the game, and maybe I'm being too romantic, it could be 30, 40 years ago. There's that unchanging element, isn't there?
Yeah, I think that's true. That the timelessness. I mean, that's interesting. You know, snooker's relationship to its own history, I think, is a fascinating thing. And there are a number of different dimensions to that. You can talk about, and people have, you know, the relationship that snooker has to its own apparent zenith in the 1980s, when it became this sort of extraordinarily this sort of central pillar of British culture. And the fact that it never is going to kind of reclaim that sort of place in the British imagination. But there is a timelessness to the game. And I think in things like the fact that the World Championship it's been tweaked every now and again, a minor tweak. The last one I can think of was the shift from first to 16 to first to 17 in the semi-finals, which I think
these are quite minor tweaks, aren't they? Let's be clear.
Yeah, exactly. So that was obviously, you know, that And you can see why they did that. But there's always that hesitancy about messing around with something that seems to be such a kind of perfect manifestation of the game. And I mentioned sort of snooker fashion and snooker dress earlier. And that's interesting too. You know, should snooker be kind of modernizing itself? Because it is ridiculous the fact that, you know, players are kind of, you know, wandering around in black tie, looking like Victorian aristocrats. But then there's also something about that and the way that it has been that way, not just through the whole history of snooker, but the fact that that actually is inherited from, you know, you can see it in engravings of Victorian billiards matches, you know, that was the what was considered to be the right way for these sort of gentlemanly professionals to dress. And so there's snooker's definitely, I guess, like any sport, you could say, but it's definitely a game where the forces of continuity and change are always pushing against each other. And, you know, so you're seeing that kind of battle and that kind of conflict.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure this is even a question, really, but I reread, because I read the book a few months ago, but I reread a couple of chapters just before we came on, and the internationalism one was struck me because of how much it's all changed since you wrote it only very recently. You know, you had a Luca Brasel quote there, but of course now he's world champion, that's all changed. And we're talking about, you know, Yan and Zhao, and, you know, they're gone. I'm not even sure what my question is, really, but it struck me how quickly that chapter has all been thrown into the air.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm glad you mentioned it, actually, because it was a, you know, I thought, as you can imagine, you know, I wrote that chapter and, you know, the book was going to press. And then in December, we know what was emerging as a story. And I included one line at the time. It was quite late in the proofing stage, a line just referencing the fact that, you know, this is a reminder that, in fact, there was the line I think I included in the falsehood chapter, which was on match fixing, a reminder that this is something that's not going away from the game. But I decided I'm going to leave these discussions, the quite optimistic discussions about Yan and about Zhao Xintong as, you know, the future or part of the future of international snooker. I'm going to leave that as a testament to, you know, kind of where we were at a particular point. And clearly right now, unfortunately, we're in a rather different position. And so there's certainly a poignancy for me looking back on those summaries of Yan and Zhao in particular, and just thinking about the fact that we're in a very different spot, and more positively, the fact that we now really excitingly have just seen the, you know, the first world champion from mainland Europe. And so in that sense, from a different angle, the internationalism of snooker is kind of entering exciting new territory.
Very much so. I've written down the name. It might not mean something to you too. It might do. It's the journalist Alan Shipnuck. Now, the reason I've written that down is he's writing a comprehensive story, really, of LIV Golf and the absolute ruptures it's caused in that sport. And I think he sent off the final draft the day before that announcement came recently of the merger. So, you know, that just reminds me of the unlucky timing that authors can sometimes have. I mean, you may have had a little, you know, maybe a few changes, but that's something that absolutely drastic. And I just, you know, this fast-paced world of things changing, that's kind of the problems you can have. But, Brendan, we should say that, of course, you know, we sort of hinted it already, but every chapter is kind of, I guess you'd call it, a life fundamental, and it's, they're titled sort of time, disorder, genius, color, luck, fashion, women, every sort of theme you can possibly think of. And probably obvious, but someone hasn't read it. It is tied in with so many sort of, you know, immortal moments if you follow this sport forever. Like obviously in music, you talk about snooker loopy. I know we joke about it, laugh about it, the Romford rap, that's all there. The chapter on loss, you know, focuses very much on maybe, sadly for many millions, the player most associated with losing matches than anyone else in the history of the game, Jimmy White, of course, with those six world finals. There's a being a TV nerd, I love the television chapter. I know it's you saying there that very interestingly that you think Hazel Irving may have surpassed David Vine. Now that's her quality that you've pinpointed. But you can't say enough that there are fundamentals here, and there are all manner of literary references and some incredibly sort of, you know, beautiful, intelligent writing. But it does link in always to the players and the moments that we sort of know so well in this sport.
Yeah, that's right. And I guess that's, you know, again, going back to the kind of the philosophy behind what I was trying to do, that I was wanting to write about snooker. I was wanting to write about the history of the game and the players and some of the conspicuous moments. Also in other places, some of the, I think, underappreciated and under-discussed elements of the game. And the chapter on women's snooker is a good example of that. I think, you know, that I was trying to, for the first time that I had seen, tell that history in detail and explore the fact that, you know, Joe Davis is, of course, a sort of conspicuous, immortal, you know, legend of the game. But some of the names like, you know, Ruth Harrison and Thelma Carpenter are talked about, you know, significantly less often, even though, you know, Ruth Harrison was equally dominant as a sort of early genius of women's snooker. So there are sort of the underappreciated narratives, but with the stuff that, you know, the big names and famous moments, I think I wanted to not just talk about what happened with Jimmy White in all those finals, but try to just test out and to explore certain things about contrasts you can make. You know, the chapter on victory, I talk a lot about Steve Davis and Stephen Hendry, not just in terms of what they did, but in terms of the psychology of winning that you see within them and how unusually intense I think that is. That, you know, there's something about that infamous moment after Davis has lost against Dennis Taylor, and he's, you know, completely grey, standing there, being interviewed by David Vine and offering these sort of one-syllable responses and being completely dead. And he's also talked about how he was just utterly devastated for months afterwards. It took him a very long time to get over that. And you compare that with Jimmy White and those sort of preternatural, this capacity to find something within himself, a kind of optimism, a kind of cheerfulness, even just seconds after losing some of those finals against Hendry. I think in 92, when he lost those 10 frames in a row, he said, you know, "I feel good even now," you know, which is an extraordinary thing to hear from him. Perhaps most famously in 94, after losing the final frame, he made that comment, you know, "He's beginning to annoy me." But, you know, it's one of the reasons why people love him so much. You know, that generosity of spirit, that capacity to lose with a sort of nobility of character and with a humour and with a sense of perspective, all of that violently absent from the personalities of people like Davis and Hendry. So I guess that's an example of the sort of thing I was wanting to do, try to explore some of these, perhaps these sort of ideas about personality types and about what the psychology of victory and loss might be, whilst also sort of talking about some of these famous moments.
Now, I probably should have asked this at the start, but it's a bit of a backwards way of doing it, but a bit more about you, if we could. Your career, how you got to the point of writing a snooker book, and the other stuff you've written about.
Yeah, so I guess my background is more in academic writing, and what I'd written before this was on literature of various kinds. You know, a book on Cold War American poetry, a critical study of William Blake, and so that's my background. That there was that, and then there's the fact that I've, you know, been completely obsessed with snooker since I was 5 years old, as I talked about earlier, and so I've always wanted that, especially. Also, given the point from earlier that I feel that the library of snooker literature is a thinner library than it should be. So it's always been in my head. It's always been an ambition of mine to sort of turn to snooker and try to find a way of writing about it in interesting fashion. So I guess that's the context, and that's sort of where I've come from, and how I sort of entered into this particular project.
Mm-hmm. And how was your delving into sort of the snooker community, as it were, I feel like they're quite a welcoming, receptive community. Has that been your experience so far?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, a community that's so full of knowledge and wisdom about the game, you know, and just what you know, what you see and what you encounter on social media, you see, you know, that a community of fans who they don't just watch the game, you know, they think about it really carefully, and they have sort of debates and discussions of various kinds about what's going on. They're attentive not just to the kind of big name players, but what's happening further down the rankings and what's happening from tournament to tournament, not just the most conspicuous tournaments too. So I think I guess I was trying to write a book for what you might describe as two different audiences, because there's that the audience of avid snooker fans, and then there is the fact that, well, when the World Championships come round, you get 4-5 million people tuning in to watch it. And I think not all of those people are following every single tournament. Not all of those people are, you know, familiar with, you know, players who are at sort of 50 or 60 in the rankings. But they're tuning in to this kind of significant cultural sporting event. And so I guess I also wanted to write something that might be of interest to, I don't want to say sort of fair weather snooker fans, but, you know, snooker fans who kind of, who maybe you watch some of the major tournaments, but aren't necessarily closely following every detail of the game across the season.
Mm-hmm. Well, that makes a lot of sense. And, well, we're just, as I said at the top, we're incredibly grateful that you did turn your attention to this sport. Now, I just want to give some idea again of the kind of variety here. And I know I think we mentioned it last time, Phil, but the index is particularly revealing, I think. And I'm going to, if you permit me a moment, just I've picked the letter P, because I think there's a particularly nice variety here. So here we go. This gives you an idea of just the incredible scope of this book from Brendan. So it's Pala Cherry, Parnook or Han, Panasar, Monty, Parrot, John, Perfection, Performance Enhancing Drugs, Perry, Joe, Philbin, Maggie, Phillips, Wendell, Pitchett, Ty, Pinches, Barry, The Pink Ball, Plank, Max, Plath, Sylvia, Plato, Paul, Pop Music, Pope, Alexander, Post Retirement Careers, Post-Truth World, Pot Black, Hound, Ezra, Powell, Mike, Power, Price, Mick, Priestley, JB, Prize Money, Psychological Strength, Pullman, John, The Purple Ball. Now that is a lineup. That would be a dinner party of a lifetime, wouldn't it? I mean,
I think it's pretty obvious how that all fits together.
before we came on air, Brendan, just before, tell us the two you mentioned in tandem, possible double act.
Oh, Pinches and Plath. Yeah, a kind
Pinches
of
and Plath, which I'm trying to think, I'm thinking what that most makes me think of. It's sort of an old school music hall act, isn't it? I'm off to see Pinches and Plath down at the in summer season.
Well, you know, I'd buy a ticket if that was on the But yeah, I think, you know, I suppose that list is indicative of the sort of thing I am trying to do in the book, which is to bring the world of ideas, but also, you know, philosophical statements and literature, to bring it to snooker and to try to sort of shine a light on snooker through some of this stuff in a manner that I hope kind of throws a certain kind of light on the game that hasn't been thrown before.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to ask you another question that I'd be fascinated to hear your answer about, generally, about the sort of state of the game. I mean, some people are quite negative about it in the future, it has to be said. Some people think that's overplayed. I mean, I think your view would be really interested to hear. Where do you think snooker fits into sort of today's sort of sporting landscape, or indeed wider landscape? Do you think we're sometimes a little bit, as a community and as a group of sort of fans and journalists, a bit too negative?
I certainly think there's an element of that. And I think in part, perhaps, there is this, you know, we're talking about snooker's relationship to its own history, this feeling that fans and followers can sometimes have, that in some way that snooker has passed its peak. And although it's obviously true that snooker is never going to be have this sort of central position in cultural life like it perhaps once had, it's really popular. The appetite for the game is there as it always has been, and it's there within millions of people. As we touched on a moment ago, in the internationalism of the game, to have Luka as the world champion now, it's a wonderful thing, but it's also emblematic of something that actually there are new territories worldwide that can be looked forward to, I think, in terms of what might happen. Luka himself has said that he feels that the game is going to explode in Belgium, explode perhaps, in Europe more broadly, partly as a result of what he's done. So there's all of that. Something that I had Luke Williams say, Luke, of course, the author of a magnificent biography of Patsy Houlihan, which, like all the best biographies, is not just about Patsy Houlihan. It tells a wonderful story of him, but it also is a book on mid-20th century amateur snooker. It's a book on South London culture of that time. Well, it's a wonderful piece of writing, and he was a really interesting figure commenting on the game. And he has made another point, which is perhaps, in terms of the grassroots support for the game, in terms of the dwindling number of snooker clubs, there are things to worry about. There are areas of concern in terms of whether we are going to continue to do the right things to maximize our support, financial support as well, for young players coming through. So I think depending on the angle you look at the game from, there are perhaps different levels of optimism to take. But I certainly feel that the appetite for following and supporting snooker is as strong as it ever has been, and in some ways stronger than ever. So I'm really hopeful, and I'm sort of clinging on to, Luka's World Championship win as a sign of something really quite electrifying. Not just that, actually, I'm sort of going on here, but the nature of Luka as a personality is just such a magnificent thing for the game of snooker. He's a sign of the future, but he's also... he also annihilates this argument that that all the characters of the game are, that's a thing of the past. You've got this guy who's sort of saying, perhaps exaggerating, the extent to which he's sort of, not sleeping and he's out drinking till 6 a.m. before matches and so forth. You've got a kind of rock star figure here as world champion. And that is a really exciting thing for the game. The nature of Luka as a player, I'm really interesting to see what he does in the season to come. It's a bit of a tradition of its own that the new first-time world champion has a bad season after winning. But if anyone can challenge that, I think Luka can, the nature of his sort of laid-back personality. So there are reasons to be really excited and reasons to be really positive, although there are complexities, I think.
Just on a personal level for you, did you have a favourite player growing up or now? Were you drawn to those rock and roll personalities, or were you more sort of the sedate side of things?
I mean, two answers, really. I mean, my idol growing up was Jimmy White, and that's not, I'm not alone in that. those finals, sort of revisiting those finals, writing the chapter on loss, and I remember how heartbroken I was, especially that 94 final. I remember feeling... when Jimmy missed that black in the final frame, I was convinced, surely Hendry's going to miss on purpose now, because it's too wrong. It's too tragic. It's too heartbreaking to have Jimmy lose again. And I just sort of couldn't believe it. No, he's not doing that. No, he's potting these balls. This is it's just awful. In adulthood, the player, a rather different kind of player who became my favourite, is the Sheriff of Pottingham, Anthony Hamilton.
Oh, excellent.
Who I think is a fascinating player in snooker history. A real underachiever, an underappreciated player for a long time. But I love following the story of his career, and the way that he, improbably won the German Masters in his mid-40s, when no one thought that he would ever win a ranking tournament. And it's a different feel following a player where, perhaps his own expectations are limited. But, and if Anthony Hamilton gets to a quarter final, it's exciting news. A different kind of feel supporting someone like him. Just a kind of really you know, a really lovely guy, I think, and really, you know, funny and interesting figure to listen to and be interviewed and so forth. So, yeah, so different answers there. Jimmy White in childhood, in adulthood, the great Anthony Hamilton.
Fantastic answers for me. Friend of the show, Anthony Hamilton.
Yeah, exactly. They're all friends of the show, Phil. You know that. Of course, yeah. I don't think there was ever a more inevitable break in the history of snooker than Hendry clearing up when he came to the table. He just was. Yeah, it was never going to be. And of course, what just comes to my mind that, you know, that he's beginning to annoy me, actually came from David Vine saying, "What can I say apart from happy birthday?" I mean, oh dear. Yeah. I mean, that was just, oh dear. I mean, yeah, you've taken me back to watching that at York University. I said it before on here. You say, oh, you get over things, but there's a tiny, tiny part of me, and I'm sure you, that won't ever get over that. And you wouldn't want to, would, in a way, would you? Because it was therein lies its importance, I think.
Yeah, and one of the things I talk about in the lost chapter is, you know, in some way it's part of why Jimmy White is so loved. You know, we struggle a lot more, I think, to identify with the kind of the winners in life, these figures who ruthlessly and successfully achieve victory consistently. That's not really how life tends to work. You know, it's those who have to struggle with failure and disappointment who we can identify with a lot more easily. There's a kind of, you know, strangeness to it, because obviously Jimmy White is actually one of the most successful snooker players ever. I think I say in the book that he was still in the top 10. I think he's not quite in the top 10 ranking tournament winners now, because I think Sean Murphy's won an 11th, and so he's just dropped off. But 10 ranking tournament victories in all of those world finals. You know, he's a player of immense success, and yet we tend to see him as emblematic of this sort of noble and tragic failures.
Absolutely. No, you summed it all up very well, and you sum up everything very well in this amazing book. What's sort of next for you then? Maybe we'll wrap up like that. I mean, what sort of subject are you tackling next?
So I am right now working on a book on cricket, on the art and literature of cricket, cricket in the English imagination, trying to trace responses, artistic and literary responses to cricket, really from some medieval manuscript illustrations. Fascinating. Right. People holding kind of what look like cricket bats. Are they cricket bats? We can't really know, but it's interesting stuff to think about, and sort of tracing things kind of through the centuries to the modern day. So all being well, that will appear sometime next year.
Oh, that's great. And I've said this for a while, actually, but we're going to wrap up, but has there been anything that you really would have liked to have talked about that we haven't explored or mentioned? I mean, please do speak up. I mean, you've just been a marvellous guest, and we encourage everyone to buy your book.
Well, that's very kind. I mean, no, it's just a privilege to, and I really, you know, it is a dreamlike phenomenon to come on this podcast and be able to talk about snooker. This is life at its very best. So I'm just very grateful to be here and to be having a conversation with you.
Bill, we're not clever enough to take clips, are we? We're too stuck in the dark age. But that's got to be a sort of soundbite, isn't it?
I think that's got to be the intro to the podcast. If we can rustle up some theme music to go with "This is life at its very best," then that's perfect.
Can I suggest the Romford Rap as the theme music?
Oh, you can, yeah.
A famous hit from yesteryear. Brendan, what can we say? Thank you so much. Will you come back and see us again one day?
I would. It would be an absolute honour. So, yes, please.
Oh, thank you very much. The honour's been all ours. And, echo what Nick said. It's an absolutely fabulous read. I've read it pretty much twice now. So, yeah, go buy it if you haven't bought it already.
And you can get it pretty much, obviously, you know, available widely among booksellers and, indeed, you know, across various parts of the internet, of course, Brendan, isn't it? And it's Deep Pocket Snooker, The Meaning of Life. So is there anywhere particularly people can get it you'd like to plug before you go?
I think, you know, it's out there in major bookshops and, the usual online sources. Hashat UK is the publisher. And so that will be one online place that you can easily find the book.
All the best then. And thank you so much for joining us. And we wish you well with the sales, of course.
Thank you so much. And thanks again for having me on.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Cheers, Radu.
What a marvellous guest there. Brendan Cooper, the author of Deep Pockets, Snooker and the Meaning of Life. Well, I feel quite a bit more intelligent now, having Brendan in my company now, Phil. I'm going to go and, all these, sports pages I'm often reading, I think if I just get myself into a little bit of, medieval manuscripts, this is where I've been going wrong all these bloody years.
Maybe. I mean, I feel a little bit less intelligent, so at least we've both gone one way or the other. But yeah, no, what a fascinating guy. And yeah, I'm sure that cricket book will be excellent as well.
Absolutely. We should say that we've had just a marvellous guest there. We have got some more snooker to talk about. And you are listening here to Talking Snooker with Phil Haig and Nick Metcalf. And we are talking now about the Championship League, which is underway, Phil. A week old, isn't it? My goodness me. And, I think you said at the top, it's been some nice action, I think. I haven't watched an immense amount of it, but every time I've tuned in, I've tended to watch the quotes-unquote lesser table. I mean, it's all subjective, on the YouTube, which is available for free on YouTube every day, by the way. I've just got in there, searched Matchroom, and it just pops up there, and you can watch it every day from midday on there. And we should say, there's been some established names, but perhaps one or two slight surprises, isn't there? We kicked off last Monday. I know we were on air for that, and that was Ashley Carty and Daniel Wells winning their group. So congratulations to them. And then the story continued last Tuesday with Martin O'Donnell and Chris Wakelin winning their groups. O'Donnell with 7 points there, three ahead of Hossein Vafai. Wakelin with six, one ahead of Ollie Lines. And on to Wednesday, it was Michael White and Robbie Williams topping their groups. Three wins out of three for White. He comfortably won his group. One of those wins over Ryan Day, actually, by 3-1. And Williams getting through with 7 points from his three matches. We say it again time and time, but Michael White's a lovely player, isn't he? It's never a surprise to see him sort of do well. And, we hope that continues.
Yeah, no, not at all. Ryan Day probably was the favourite. He definitely would have been a favourite because he's had a lot of success in the Championship League over the years. But, also no surprise to see Michael White do well. He's continued his ascent up the rankings from when he came back on tour and was like obviously sort of falsely really far down. But he's a top player, really, isn't he?
Really is. On to Thursday, then. Kyron Wilson and Tepchaya are new top in their groups. Wilson with three wins out of three and finishing 3 points ahead of a very recent friend of the podcast, Phil, Louis Heathcote, was on with us a couple of weeks ago and still a lovely episode that. So if you want to listen to that, please do. Kyron close to 147, Phil, missing the final pink. So had to settle for 134. And Tepchaya also comfortably winning his group. Three wins out of three, finishing 3 points ahead of Florian Nusler. And then good to see one of the young guys getting a tryout on Friday, Phil. Mark Williams, I think he's from Wales. Looks good. Looks the par. He's got a big future, this one. But seriously, though, 32nd season on tour. And, he certainly did look the part. Three wins and three matches, only losing one frame, two centuries and six half centuries. And the evergreen, timelessly special Williams. And Barry Pinches, that made the combined group winners that day with an age of 100, the grand old age. And shouldn't harp on that, but they you can't put a price on experience, Phil. Pinches did very well, actually, 7 points in three matches to finish one ahead of Julien Leclerc. Perhaps you shouldn't have that much surprise in my voice. Barry's been around forever, of course, top player. But very much the day for the veterans, that one, wasn't it? And but also, let's just say, Kyron and Mark Williams, they must have been doing a bit of practice, Phil, in these sort of quieter weeks.
Well, I'm not so sure, really. I mean, Williams always insists he doesn't do any, and by social media, he's been sort of jetting around. And I think Kyron just got back for a stag do, so maybe it was just the relaxation of it that got through. But yeah, I mean, it's no surprise to say that Mark Williams and Kyron Wilson played exceptionally well, but they really did. They looked really brilliant. coming off a summer break. So yeah, they'll want to keep that up. And yeah, it was interesting to see. So Barry Pinches is now, he's fallen off, so he's an amateur. And with Martin O'Donnell, Daniel Wells and Ashley Carty, they're all back on, but they were all amateur players last year. So them all topping their group just shows what the scene is off the main tour. There's a lot of very good players knocking around. I guess Barry sort of playing Q school and stuff will have helped keep him sharp over the summer. But yeah, very impressive stuff. And yeah, I'm the same as you. I sort of watch bits and pieces. I didn't realise I had Viaplay Extra, but if you've got Sky, it comes with that. So I've watched a bit on there. But it's nice to see some names you don't often see. Watched a bit of Florian Nusli, he's a good player. Nice to see Louis Heathcote getting a couple of wins. And then a couple of players I hadn't seen before. Jun Jiang, I watched play against Ryan Day. As ever, players that you've never seen before pop some excellent balls and you think, wow, he's going to be amazing, but it's all about the consistency. I watched Liam Pullen, actually, in his group. A 17-year-old, actually, it's his 18th birthday in about a week and a half. But he got his first win on tour, beating Anton Kazakov and got a draw against Ollie Lyne. So, encouraging start for him. And I spoke to him a couple of days after that. Really committed, hard-working young player. Travels to Leeds to the Northern every day from York. And quite literally is every day sometimes, at least 6 days a week, if not seven. So he puts in the hours and got no real doubt that he's going to get some good wins on the tour this season. So, yeah, there's an interview up on Metro with him. And there's one with Liam Graham as well, who's starting his Championship League campaign. And as we speak, Monday afternoon, young Scottish lad, who, and I'm going to sound a million years old here, but speaking to them both, they were both very impressive young men, spoke very well, very mature, very committed and excited to get going. But, yeah, sometimes you speak to some of the younger players on tour, they haven't been interviewed that much, they're a bit not too sure of themselves, but you couldn't say that about either of the Liams. Very confident and nice to speak to.
Yeah, you have to just sort of laugh and be complimentary or you cry. When I think of myself at 17, 18, I mean, just the idea that I'd be able to sort of do anything that well, but let alone talk that well about anything. I mean, I was just, say shambles would be a bit harsh, but so we say half a shambles. they were smashing interviews. Yeah, they really did come over very well indeed. Yeah, I've watched mainly the sort of the other table on YouTube. I did put that clip. I don't know if anyone saw it, of Elliot Slesser, who seemed very unhappy with the table conditions. I think it was Slesser and Victor Sarkis I watched actually during one. It was one lunchtime in the cricket, one of those where, you know, obviously the Ashes cricket. We shouldn't presume that everyone listening to us is into the Ashes or into cricket, but for us here, most of us sports fans in this country, it's a very big deal. But it did actually take my attention. It was kind of like a bit of a weird energy about the match, really. There was all sort of complaints and arguments about free ball at one stage. Elliot was kind of complaining about the table, which I must admit, looking at that clip, didn't look the smoothest run on that ball, I have to say. But yeah, no, it has been nice to see some of the other players. And yeah, good point about Poe there. I did see that picture. His brother was there and a few other characters, weren't they? They'd been out sort of drinking. So I'm not sure that, well, listen, Phil, let's be honest now. And Brendan spoke about this earlier with the old Luca. They're all going to take the Luca Purcell path to glory now, aren't they? You know, never mind practice. Chuck that out of the window. All the norms. Do you remember? I know it's some funny tangent to go off, but when Luca was first talking about that during the World Championship, I wouldn't say it was sort of disgust from Alan McManus, and to some extent Jimmy White, which is a bit rich from Jimmy, bearing in mind his past, but certainly from Alan, it was a bit like, well, you could see his mind worrying. He had to ask him, what do you mean? Why not? It just couldn't. It's just not the way to do it. But listen, life's a rich tapestry, Phil Hague.
Yeah, no, I remember that. That was sort of, yeah, Jimmy sort of looked surprised, but obviously he could recognise it somewhere. But yeah, that's complete, like, alien to someone like Alan McManus, you know, not preparing properly, not putting in the hours. But yeah, I mean, maybe that's the new way of things. People just going out boozing, not practising much. Hey, maybe that's the way to get young players into the game. You don't need to practise anymore. You just have a few drinks and be very successful. You could see a wave of new players coming in.
Yeah. Well, some good players this week. Nice player. I had a quick look before we came on. Jimmy Robertson in action today, former ranking event winner. Stuart Bingham, former world champion, former Masters champion in action tomorrow, Tuesday in the UK. Zhao Yulong among the players in action on Wednesday. Ali Carter, another evergreen star of snooker, playing on Thursday. Robert Milkins, who's had such great success lately, is one of the players that on coming up on Friday. And then their Saturday play, I think I'm right in saying this coming week, so different from the first week when they had the weekend off. And Si Jui He will be seeing on that day. That's the man, of course, who had that stunning run to the World Championship semi-finals. So we are missing a lot of big names, sort of superstar names, but there are plenty of you know, tremendous sort of stars still taking part, and that we'll enjoy this event. It will continue to meander along, won't it, Phil? And it will give us good company. We should say there's loads of great sport at the moment, isn't there? Wimbledon's just starting here today, Monday in the UK. The Ashes series in full swing. The Open Golf around the corner. So with the greatest win in the world, snooker really has to fight for its corner. And I know there's debate. So we had a couple of bits of correspondence in actually about this, which perhaps we'll turn to soon. I think we'll have enough pretty much time-wise coming soon for this episode. People sort of saying they don't feel it's right for this event. They don't feel it's high profile enough. It just doesn't hold their interest. I mean, each to their own. I kind of feel, you know, late June, early July, if you came with a, you know, full bells and whistles ranking event, I seriously worry about whether the column inches and the broadcast interest might be there at a time when there's so much incredible sport. So it's an interesting one, a nuanced one. Someone wrote to me and said that I think nuance should be on the bingo card. I say it so much. Apparently, I say it as much as gravitas, possibly. So that's a turn up. But I mean, listen, I have to say, no real complaints from me. I think it's probably the sensible way to go, to have this sort of slow burning, lower key event. You know, there's plenty of time when we come to the more traditional snooker months of autumn, winter, and spring for the much more traditional, bigger tournaments, eh?
Yeah, and it's so long. It would feel weird if the season almost sort of went on pause so we could fit in a month of Championship League sort of in the more business-endy bit of the season. So, yeah, I mean, maybe there could be like a proper curtain raiser, short, like limited field. Here's the season starting, and then this would happen just straight away afterwards. So, yeah, I've spoke to some players who actually quite like it because there's not much pressure on. You can sort of ease yourself into the season. But then I was saying to Liam Graham, because it's his first pro tournament, he felt it was a bit underwhelming because he said if you're not in the snooker world, you wouldn't even really know it's on, which is a fair point from him. It's a low-key way to make your sort of pro debut. But, I mean, it is what it is, isn't it? And like you said, we're missing some names, but there's so many like intriguing-looking groups. I was looking at one, just a sort of table two on Thursday, which is Wu Yizhe, Pang Junzhu, Hamad Mir and Stan Moody. I'd be really interested to watch those games. Three of the brightest young talents of the game, and Hamad Mir is a bit older, but he's always very exciting to watch. Great potter. I mean, a group like that, sort of low-key, table two on a Thursday, but great stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I've said many times on it, gambling is not really my vice, but I know many people will gamble on everything in snooker, including this, and I imagine the odds for that will be interesting. You'd be hard-pressed to pick the sort of order of one to four there, but very, very interesting, and we look forward to the Championship League continuing. I think we're done for that now, Phil. Let's move on and say congratulations to Rob Walker. We should say he has completed his nationwide cycle and run from John O'Groats to Land's End, our friend and colleague. He did it, of course, in memory of three friends of his who have all sadly died recently, and particularly heartbreakingly, a friend of his young son who also died. He raised money for two fabulous charities, the Brain Tumor Charity and the Jessie May Children's Hospice. And the last time I checked, the total was in excess of 32,000. So typical Rob, he managed to get himself, you know, pretty well across the media, including once on Good Morning Britain, live in the morning, Phil. So that was, I think John Higgins on that morning, wasn't he? Who's joining us very soon. We'll remind you of that later. Typical Rob. He didn't look that tired. I mean, I get knackered sort of walking to the shops of a morning, Phil. I mean, come on. I'm not quite that bad. I'm playing up. But yeah, I mean, come on. He didn't come across as a man that just sort of cycled a man down the nation, did he? He's something else. He really is.
Oh, he's a machine in many ways. Yeah, and he's an incredibly fit bloke. So one of those things where when he said he was doing it, I mean, if almost anyone else I know said he was doing Land's End, John O'Groats to Land's End, he'd be like, bloody hell, I hope you've been training. But he's sort of been training his whole life. Like, I don't think he did too much extra for that mammoth thing. But yeah, amazing. I know he started at 25 grand and he upped his target to 30 and he's past that. So I've got the Just Giving page up now and it's still open. So if anyone hasn't donated yet, still chance. Yeah, for an amazing achievement, for a great cause. So yeah, congratulations to Rob.
It's being doubled as well, isn't it? Is that right? If it goes over a certain amount,
I think they were matching 25 grand, so it's gonna get a big boost. Yeah, so it's gonna be a huge amount of money, which is great.
Yeah, it really is brilliant stuff. And we say congratulations to Rob if you happen to be listening, and no doubt we'll see you in person in the new season and offer our own personal congratulations, I'm sure, on behalf of sort of snooker fans and snooker people everywhere. Well, unlikely here, Phil. Just started July, but I've got a Christmas television schedule here. That's okay for coming up. A bit old school, perhaps. We've got 11 a.m. Noel Edmonds live from Telecom Tower. That's one for the teenagers. I can see your face. Where is he going with this? Midday, top of the pops. I'm not sure I should have done this, really. Never mind, I'll start it now. 3 p.m., the King's Speech. 10 past 3, E.T. the Extraterrestrial, famous old film. At 5 past 5, Doctor Who. Where I'm going with this, of course, is there's a gap in the schedule, Phil, for a couple of hours in the afternoon. But it could be filled by the Macau Masters. Heavens above. Ronnie O'Sullivan. I need a lot of stamina for that, didn't I? Ronnie O'Sullivan, Judd Trump, Jack Lazowski, Marco Fu and Si Chai He have all been there in recent days to promote this new event. We're told that three more players to be involved will be Ding Junhui, Mark Williams and Kyron Wilson. So they're not short of talent and star quality. Independent of WST, not part of the tour at all. So if it does go ahead, Phil, it'll be very strange. You know, the old turkey and trimmings, friends and family. Excuse me, I've got to go and watch a bit of the beautiful table game.
Well, yeah, no, it's an interesting one. Yeah, that sort of got announced. People sort of caught it through social media. Because, yeah, like you say, it's an unsanctioned sort of separate, basically like an exhibition tournament, really. I spoke to a colleague at the WPBSA, and I think that's the difference. So unsanctioned, there's a bit of sort of, there wasn't entire clarity about that, what I meant, but it basically won't be televised. So our dreams of watching snooker on Christmas Day won't be happening, because I think that's the sort of distinction between what would be, you know, players can go and play exhibitions, can go and play pro-ams and do what they want, really. But as soon as it's streamed or broadcast, that's when it sort of infringes onto the sanctioned event. So whoever's in the Wynn Palace in Macau will have a lovely old time from the 25th to the 29th of December, but we won't be able to watch it from over here. But yeah, amazing stuff, really, for what is effectively an exhibition tournament. 150 grand for the winner. You can see why these guys are ditching their traditional Christmas dinner at home and going off to Macau for the festive period.
I'm absolutely refusing to believe that that won't be available to watch, Phil Hague. I shall be getting myself set up with a Beijing postcode anytime soon, turning my aerial to. There'll definitely be a way to watch that, and I'll be tuning in. That's all I'm saying. Maybe no official way, but, you know, rules are there to be broken. But it is interesting, isn't it? Because we often said, you know, it is a quieter time of year. And actually, maybe that's right. I like that sort of break and then the Masters coming up in the new year and what have you. I think it sort of works quite well. And it feels like another sport that you love very much. Darts has that slot very much for itself, doesn't it? With their massive event, Ali Pali. But you never know. You know, it might be, if it's something that, you know, there is interest around, even if people can't see it in a mainstream sense, then, you know, maybe it's something to look for in the future, but it shows that there, you know, there's the appetite for players to sort of play, they can, you know, earn money in those sort of quieter times. So it will be interesting to look at. And Phil, maybe we should talk about ourselves now and next week. John Higgins with us. Goodness, keep your questions coming in for John, please. We've had some smashing ones in already. We'll keep the lines open until maybe about probably I'm thinking about Thursday. So still time for you to contact us, talkingsnooker@yahoo.com or tweet us @talkingsnooker. And, well, we just have to say, Phil, we've had loads of people so excited about this episode. We are ourselves. We can't wait for John to talk about his incredible life in the game, and it'll be a real treat for us.
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to have to be sort of, this is going to be one of those pre-podcast meetings that we're quite rare for us, but we're going to have to be quite disciplined because I'm sure you could talk to John for hours and hours and hours about his career. But we'll have to keep it to at least a fairly reasonable length. So yeah, keep the questions coming. We'll have plenty of our own and yeah, lot to look forward to.
Yeah, I don't think he'll be very happy with hours and hours and hours. Yeah. I think we have to be quite disciplined, don't we? Which we're very grateful to say that I don't think we said it on here. We said it on social media. Probably should have said it on here about one question each. But we have a couple that are coming with those. And that's fine. We are going to have to select one each from those. But most of you have come really nice brief questions. And that's obviously what we really would like because we'll be so pushed for so many things to talk to John about. We'll not get your points over. And so far, you know, we've had some smashing questions in. We really have about, you know, John's incredible life, career in the game and just what a phenomenal character he is. Well, if Mark Williams ended to go by this early form, Phil, then we won't be writing that famous class off anytime soon. We'll be seeing Ronnie for a while, of course, or John, but John will be fascinating on here. And I think that's it, really. Any other business? I don't think I have... Much more here. John Higgins coming up, as we say. Championship League continues. And the bloody Ashes. No, that's not going to be a quiet day at the library for you, is it, in Leeds?
No, I don't think so. No, going up there. So I was at uni in Leeds, so I'm going to meet some old uni pals on the Saturday, which will be lively. And then I'll be there on the Sunday. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to that. Last time I was watching a test match at Headingley, Ben Stokes scored quite a memorable innings to beat Australia on the final day of a test. So hoping for something similar.
Were you in that one?
Yeah.
I don't remember that. Wow. No, that was it. That must be up there in any of the great things you've seen in sport, mustn't it be?
Yeah, it was amazing. Yeah. What a weekend. It was my birthday on the Friday. I was at a wedding in North Yorkshire on the Saturday, then heading me on the Sunday for that. Doesn't get much better.
No, absolutely. Well, it's even half as special as that game you saw 4 years ago, and then we'll be in for a treat in that. And well, I think we'll say goodbye. Thanks for your company. We had a smashing guest, didn't we, in Brendan Cooper. And yeah, we do encourage you to buy this book, Deep Pocket Snooker and the Meaning of Life. It's got everything in it, Phil. And we should say, you know, also Luke G. Williams, who Brendan mentioned, and our friend John Skilbeck have all written books. So we are short of snooker literature, snooker books, but not so much in 2023 because they're all come out. They're all just basically coming out around about now. So we encourage you to read Luke G. Williams on Patsy Houlihan, John Skilbeck on the 1982 World Championship, Goody Two Shoes, and this book by Brendan Cooper. Our cup runneth over, year of our Lord 23, Phil.
Yeah, and I was also very excited to hear Dave Hendon's tease that he's embarking on a project to write a book. So that's not out now, not out for a little bit, but that's sure to be excellent when it does come.
Indeed. Dave, one of the great voices. And yes, that is now bound to be a wonderful tome to look forward to. We've got to go. Thanks for your company. Enjoy the test. Enjoy your week. See you next time with John Higgins.
Yeah, pleasure as always. And thanks again for Brendan. What a great guest.
Thanks for listening. Keep your thoughts coming to us with John Higgins or for any snooker matter, talkingsnooker@yahoo.com or tweet us at talkingsnooker. For now, thank you for listening in from Brendan, Phil and myself. Cheerio. Sports Social Podcast Network.